Welcome back. Today, finally, we will reap the fruits of all these efforts and conclude the discussion of cosmology and the derivation of the primordial power spectrum in the cosmic microwave background, the scalar part and the tensor part. Just a few minor details that will come up today when we put everything together. And then next week will be the last week of teaching. There we will do the Andrew effect again, but from a different perspective, from methods that allow us then to do the Hawking effect. And we will do the Hawking effect in, you know, there are multiple ways you can derive the Hawking radiation. But I will present you the way in which I think it is the way that's the most stable one. Other derivations, like Hawking's original derivation, suffer from certain assumptions. For example, that there's an ultraviolet cutoff and you can track modes to arbitrarily close to the horizon and arbitrarily small distances from the horizon, and there is no evidence that that is realistic. Therefore, the question was raised whether Hawking's derivation even holds, and therefore other derivations have been found, and we will do one of those that is more robust. Okay, so today we complete the discussion of quantum field theory as applied to cosmology. And here's the bigger picture. Remember, we discussed the possible origin of inflation, which included a possible origin of our universe. That has to be said is very speculative. On the other hand, if we do have a scalar field with a potential, this is definitely a possibility. Doesn't mean that our universe came about this way. We just don't have strong evidence or any evidence really for that, other than a scalar field with a potential seems to explain the rest. But be that as it may, that appears to be the most likely scenario at the moment. And then we discussed the period of inflation, which lasted until about 10 to the minus 32 seconds. And then after inflation ended, all of the energy that was in this elevated potential, the elevated inflaton potential, and I remember that was an enormous amount of energy, because even though it started out with an elevated energy in an area just a few Planck lengths across, the universe expanded underneath that while keeping the potential value the same, because it behaves dynamically in the Einstein equations just like a cosmological constant. And that energy density in the cosmological constant doesn't get diluted during inflation. So that was the ultimate energy production. And remember that the cosmological constant and the potential are not really special in that they have positive energy density. What makes them special, what makes them make the universe expand rather than contract, is that they come with negative pressure. Whereas regular matter is having positive pressure. That's what makes a scalar field so special. It imitates a cosmological constant, and that means negative pressure. Okay, so after inflation ended, all of that energy from the inflaton potential had to go somewhere, and it went into the production of all kinds of, all species of particles. So that at the end of inflation, we have what looks like a hot Big Bang, a scenario right after a hot Big Bang, a universe that's very much filled with hot plasma. That is to say, it's filled with radiation. All the particles are so energetic that they are highly relativistic, and therefore the masses don't really matter. They behave as if they were massless. In fact, initially they were massless. The standard model of particle physics contains the Higgs mechanism, and the Higgs mechanism gives particles their mass. But at sufficiently high temperatures, the theory doesn't settle in the minimum. And therefore, there is no vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field. And we have that the fields don't have mass yet. In fact, it's thought to have taken until about 10 to the minus 11 seconds, until then we have that the particles acquire mass. It's also where the weak force and the electromagnetic force separate ways, because the weak force is carried by particles that have mass, and electromagnetism is, of course, carried by photons, which do not have mass. And at energies higher than the energies to the left of here, earlier than that, they are not distinguished. And in fact, there is this unifying group of the electroweak theory. Then between 10 to the minus 11 and about 1 second, I don't remember exactly where it was, but nuclei form. Protons and neutrons can form, which is non-trivial, because at sufficiently high energies, they just form a quark gluon plasma. It's too hot. And then when it cools down enough, they can condense into protons and neutrons, for example. Quark gluon plasmas have been recreated in the lab, for example, at RIG. You just smash nuclei into each other, and you can then check what happens. They will collide, they will form a bubble, and then the fragments will fly off. Now, if the collision energy is high enough, then the result of the collision will essentially internally boil. It will go through that phase transition, become a phase, a quark gluon plasma, and then it will fragment differently, as if the collision happened at lower energies, where the quark gluon plasma hasn't formed yet. It's a bit like the difference between ice colliding and water droplets colliding. Then at about, from about 1 second until like 10 minutes or so, nuclei form. Mostly, of course, it's just protons that stay alone, but there's also helium and lithium and a few light elements that will be formed in small amounts. And then the era of radiation domination ends. Radiation domination means, remember, that the energy momentum tensor is dominated by radiation terms. And then matter starts dominating. How do we see that this is inevitable? How do we see that matter domination has to follow after radiation domination? Well, it's because, as we discussed before, when you have a box filled with light, then as the box expands, for example, the box could be a chunk of the universe, and then it has this Hubble expansion, then the particles that are in there will be diluted. It's the same number of particles, but in a bigger box. Now, radiation not only has its particles, its photons, diluted when the box increases in size, but the particles, the photons, also expand their wavelength, and that makes the energy density decay even faster. Now, the same is true for matter, actually. Matter also has waves, it has a wave description, and those wavelengths get also longer. But remember that when you look at the dispersion relation, and I'm just saying really simple things here, omega is square root of, and then you have k vector squared plus m squared, and then you have that as the universe expands, the k vector, the wave vector, even of matter fields, will of course get smaller and smaller, because the wavelength gets larger and larger. But even if that goes to zero, for massive particles, it doesn't mean that the energy density goes to zero. Photons lose their energy continuously towards zero. Right? If the universe keeps expanding, the photons just keep losing energy, the individual photons, because they become redshifted. But not so an electron, for example, because even if its momentum is tremendously small, it at least has E equal mc squared as an energy that's not going to be diluted. And so eventually, as these drop towards zero, those terms survive, and what we end up with is that the energy momentum tensor becomes dominated by matter. And that happens at about 10 to the 13 seconds. See, this is a time axis in a logarithmic scale. Of course, this is not proportional, right? This is the logarithmic scale. We are drawing here orders of magnitude. And 10 to the 13 seconds is about 100,000 years. So at about 100,000 years, that transition from radiation to matter domination happens. It's not like nobody knows when that happens. It's just that I don't know exactly the numbers. But you can definitely look this stuff up. And there is a lot of precision, actually, precision results that we have on this. But this graph is only to give the overall idea of the orders of magnitude. So eventually, when the universe is matter-dominated, eventually it's not only matter-dominated, but also it cools down enough because of the expansion. It cools down enough for electrons and protons to stick together and to form atoms, mostly hydrogen. And that happens at about 300,000 years or so. And the universe goes on like this then, and everything is usual cosmology. The inflaton field doesn't play a role at that point anymore. And also the cosmological constant that we have recently discovered over the past 20 years doesn't play a role yet. The universe is really dominated by the matter in the energy momentum tensor. Just like here, the behavior of the universe was dominated by the radiation in the energy momentum tensor. Here it's dominated by the inflaton field's potential, the energy momentum tensor, right? And what that means is here we have an almost exponential expansion. So we have accelerated expansion. Here we have decelerating expansion. And here we have decelerating expansion with different rates because the energy dilutes at different rates. So we have also that the deceleration is at different scalings. And then roughly about now, which is not meant to mean today, but give and take a few billion years, it's just orders of magnitude here. How often do you get to say today after give and take a billion? roughly in our era now, I don't know, 3-4 billion years ago, the transition happened and the energy momentum tensor is no longer dominated by the matter content in the universe, which, by the way, includes dark matter. Most of it, by far most of it, is dark matter. But even the dark matter no longer dominates the energy momentum tensor. Instead, it's the dark energy. It's a cosmological constant, which, as far as we know, really is a constant, rather than being another scalar field, which has, for some reason, a very, very slowly decaying elevated potential. So we assume this is probably a cosmological constant. So that transition already happened because we have evidence that the universe actually is accelerating again, its expansion. Up to here, it was decelerating, and then it made a transition into acceleration again. Sometimes it's visualized in a way similar to this. This would be a picture similar to what you might be obtaining in the project when you calculate quantum fluctuations of a field. And then about here, we would have a universe that's still pretty much structureless. There is no galaxies or stars. But we would have some gravitational wells and troughs remaining from the endpoint of inflation. Remember that at the endpoint of inflation was set where the inflaton field rolled down the inflaton's potential. That's what ended inflation. And on that space-like hypersurface where that happened, it's the fluctuations in the intrinsic gravity that are left over from inflation. Well, and then these inhomogeneities are thought to have seeded the initial structure, the initial conditions for the structure formation in the universe, how hydrogen clouds condensed into galaxies and stars. And so over time, then, we obtain this picture. The cosmic microwave background radiation stems from this point in time here, when atoms formed, because before that, when the protons and electrons were still moving so fast that they could not stick together, the universe was still ionized. It was a plasma rather than a gas. And a plasma is pretty much opaque for light because photons care about charges. And if all they encounter is charges all the way, then they don't travel very far. So it's basically opaque. But the moment the temperature cooled down so much that electrons and protons could find each other and form neutral atoms, well, then it was filled with hydrogen. And hydrogen is a colorless, transparent, odorless gas, which Carl Sagan also said is, if you give it enough time, it turns into people, right? Because all of this, and then there's a planet in which people form it. It's quite amazing to think of it this way, right? That hydrogen can finally turn into people. And then those people discuss that sort of thing. Sagan also said that life is a way for the universe to study itself, to observe itself, to become aware of itself. Okay, so that's the overall picture here. And we are not so sure about the beginning. We are not so sure about the end. Is that really all there is? Is it just dark energy dominates? If so, and that's all the evidence we have at the moment, if so, then the universe will just continue to expand forever, in fact, in an accelerated way. And it might just become very boring because everything just gets ripped apart. And after sufficiently many billions or trillions of years, we wouldn't even see neighboring galaxies, and eventually the galaxy would be ripped apart, and yeah, it would be a sad place. But there's no way that we can predict what will happen here. We would not have here, if we had lived here, we would not have predicted that. So now we live here, we have no way of predicting what might happen over there. Now, at this point, when the universe cooled down enough so that protons and electrons could form hydrogen, the universe became transparent, and the photons that were traveling at the time then were no longer scattering off ions, and therefore they have been traveling ever since. I mean, some of them have run into all sorts of dust and stars and so on, but there were so many that they're still filling the universe. And their distribution reflects the fluctuations in the space-time and the fluctuations of the plasma at that point. It's important to realize that at that point, when inflation ended, we had fluctuations in gravity. But when inflation ended, it filled the universe with all species of particles. The universe was filled with a plasma. And that plasma experienced these inhomogeneities in gravity, which means that the plasma was not just sitting there, but it was exposed to these fluctuations, which means that it was as if the plasma was excited by sound. And so you then had not only that the plasma had, you know, over and under densities, but the whole thing became dynamical. And so you had these waves traveling and reverberating through the universe. That's plasma physics, which you can recreate in the lab in principle. Plasma physics is not that speculative. And so the density fluctuations that we have at the end of inflation, or the intrinsic curvature fluctuations, I should say, that we have at the end, beginning of inflation, undergoes a period of plasma physics, including the propagation of acoustic waves in the plasma, which eventually leads to inhomogeneities in that cosmic microwave background radiation that have then been liberated at that point. The light was liberated to travel freely, and we observe that today. And so today we get a snapshot of what the inhomogeneities were at that time. So the great thing of the about the cosmic microwave background is that we can see the fluctuations there. What would be very cool is if we could also measure not only the photon background, but also the neutrino background, which was emitted earlier. It would give us an even earlier picture, but not yet. So the statistics of the cosmic microwave background is that it is currently filling the universe in empty space with about 411, yes, we know it that much, 411 cosmic microwave background photons at any given point in time per cubic centimeter. And because it's all over the place, it was already discovered in the 60s when people were not looking for it. They used microwaves for communication, and they noticed a particular source of noise that seemed to come from everywhere. And it turned out the cosmic microwave background to be the cosmic microwave background radiation. Now, when they say it's 411 photons per cubic centimeter, strictly speaking, that's not a good way to say it, because these photons are microwaves. They're in the microwave region, which means they have wavelengths of several centimeters. So you can't really count them in one cubic centimeter. You would have to scale this up, let's say, to a cubic meter. So you have a million times, you have 411 million per cubic meter. And that makes more sense, because these photons are, if you want to think of them as wave packets, they're not going to be any more localized at best as like a few centimeters. Their spectrum is pretty much a Planckian spectrum. At every point in the sky, this is like a world map, but outward looking. Every point in the sky, you can measure the temperature, and you can also measure the spectrum of the temperature, and it's very accurately a black body spectrum, just like Planck predicted it, not for the CMB, but just any black body spectrum. It's very close to that, and when you measure the temperature of it, it's about 2.7 Kelvin, and we measure it with an accuracy better than 10 to the minus 5. See, it has fluctuations from one point to the other of one part in 100,000, and we measure them with accuracy. And I think I mentioned that, right, how that's measured. Every pixel, for example, could be a piece of superconducting material. And then depending on the temperature, it will or will not make that material superconducting or not. And since it's a phase transition, it's a very steep slope, the change of conductivity. And in this way, you have very sensitive temperature measurements. If you wrap this up on a globe, then it looks like that. But of course, now we are, we should think of it as being in the center of that sphere and looking outward. Also, the polarization has been measured of the cosmic microwave background, and you can think of that as a vector field, because there it's not about the heat, but the polarization of the cosmic microwave background radiation, and you can visualize it as a vector field. It's not really a vector field, because there is no difference between being polarized this way or that way, right? It's just like horizontal or vertical. But still, you can decompose it into a gradient and a curl component. The average polarization is only one part in a million. We can measure that, even with accuracy. But the trouble is that the polarization, the curl part of the polarization that is most interesting for our purposes, because the curl part of the polarization is generated by the quantized gravitational waves from inflation. But the curl part is, unfortunately, mostly gradient parts that have been turned into curl parts by foreground. When gradient parts of the polarization travel through, I don't know what kind of pollutants between us and the source, typically galactic foreground, I imagine gases, they can lead to polarization. Okay, so how did we calculate these things? Remember, because now we want to figure out exactly how we match the calculations to that picture. So we decomposed the inflaton field into a part which is zero mode, so it's space independent, only time dependent. We call it phi naught. We did not quantize that part. It was the bulk of the inflaton field. It is what drives most of the energy momentum tensor and therefore of the expansion of the universe. But we also take into account, assuming though that it's small, the space dependencies. So we assume that the absolute value of phi is smaller than that, or the absolute value of the expectation value, because this is going to be quantized, is smaller than this. Also, the metric we decomposed into a zero mode, a part that is not space dependent, only time dependent, as if it was FRW cosmology. But we do allow perturbations around that FRW Lemaître cosmology by adding this metric part. We assume, though, for the validity of our calculations, that this part is small. Then this means that we decompose the metric, or the invariant distance, into an FRW metric with a scale factor function A of eta. And then contributions due to this gamma perturbation of the metric, which are of scalar origin, of vector origin, or of tensor origin, and spelled out, it was these contributions. The scalar part of the metric had scalar functions in here that make this a tensor, even though these are scalar functions. You just suitably differentiate the scalars, just like you get from a scalar potential to a gradient electric field in electromagnetism. And then there was the vector part, and there is the tensor part. Then we used the fact that we can change coordinate systems willy-nilly, pretty much. But we didn't use it to the extreme. We were just perturbing around the FRW. And if we do that, then by changing coordinates, we can change those functions in here. And it turns out that we can remove most of them. And after a lot of work, one finds that there are 2 degrees of freedom that are left. One is the tensor part of the metric, which itself decomposes into 2 degrees of freedom because it has 2 polarizations. The gravitational waves have 2 polarizations. And a part, another degree of freedom, the Mukhanov variable. Mukhanov is the same Mukhanov as co-author of the book that I recommended for this course. There's the Mukhanov variable, and it's a linear combination of this scalar part of the metric that was here. It's just a part that bloats the metric locally. And of the change in the inflaton field. And we also gained some intuition for why exactly that factor is needed there. Remember, the overall idea was that since we have a slow roll inflation, we know that the inflaton field has to go, and overall it has a trend of moving down that inflaton potential. And that meant that a fluctuation in the inflaton field, whether it's larger or smaller, can be reinterpreted as being later or earlier in that overall trend. And that allowed us to relate fluctuations in the inflaton field to localized increased expansion or lagging behind in the expansion that's expressed through that psi. So they can physically not be distinguished, the two, during inflation, because you can just change coordinate system and make all the fluctuations be due to the inflaton field or all of them due to the metric. And then we said that at the end of inflation, that ambiguity goes away, because the end of inflation is defined when phi, when the inflaton field rolls down the potential, I mean, rolls fast down the potential. And that defines the end of inflation And that's when a lot of particles get created, because the inflaton potential quickly decays into all sorts of other particles. At that point, the consensus seems to be that at that point we had, that would be the latest that the quantum fluctuations that we had calculated become actual physical fluctuations. Because now you have a lot of witnesses to the fluctuations, namely all those particles that have been created. They, you know, one system decoheres another. You may know that if you have two systems, two independent systems, and they're not entangled, and then you have an interaction between the two, then you can view that as each system measuring the other. One system, system A interacts with system B, entanglement between the two is being generated, and that can be viewed as one system performing a measurement on the other. Why? Well, because if A and B have interacted, now I can perform a measurement of B and learn something about A, right? Because the properties of B depend on what happened in that collision. And more formally speaking, after A and B have interacted, they are entangled, and that means that if you trace over one, you find that the evolution of the other was no longer unitary. It's what is called the quantum channel, and you have that the pure state turns into a mixed state, just as if a measurement happened, because actually a measurement happened. In general, that's what happens there. And so you have a decoherence then, and what used to be a quantum uncertainty, namely coherent superpositions of either this or that, in a measurement becomes actual classical superpositions. So the latest that this transition from quantum fluctuation to real fluctuation could have happened is at the end of inflation. However, it's been argued, and I guess I can agree with this. It's been argued that the decoherence actually happens earlier, namely that every mode, every individual mode, has its decoherence time. And when would that be? The idea is that it decoheres very soon after the mode crosses the Hubble horizon. And why is that? Well, it's because what we get is a squeezed state. The state is very much squeezed then. And we saw it in the form of the behavior that the oscillators, instead of being oscillatory, become exponentially increasing, exponentially decreasing. And that means that the linear combination becomes very squeezed. Only one contribution dominates, the one of the exponentially increasing solution. And the exponentially decreasing solution contributes less and less. But you couldn't do without it. It's still there. And squeezed states have this property that they are very fragile in a certain sense. You can, you know, it would go too far in this course, but let me just give you the gist of it. Consider a Schrödinger cat. But let's not be brutal to the cat. Let's just say it's not either dead or alive. Let's say the cat is either here or it's there. You can write down a state in which a particle or a cat is either here or there in coherent superposition. And then you can ask, how quickly would such a state decohere? If there's any interaction, how fast would it decohere? And one can show, and in fact I worked it out with a PSI student a few years ago, that if the cat is in a coherent superposition of being either here or just a tiny little bit to the side, then the state will decohere upon interaction, but much more slowly than if the superposition is between the cat being here and there. It's the same. It's very similar with squeeze states. In fact, you can map it onto that. So that means that a mode, after crossing the horizon, gets into a very vulnerable state, which very easily would be decohered. So the quantum fluctuations that, remember, freeze in size of the horizon crossing, they are thought to decohere very quickly after the horizon crossing. But what's the witness? What is observing it, right? And the idea is that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It could be gravity itself. It could be other particles. Some particles might other fields. The idea is that the squeezing is so extreme that the tiniest of interactions, even of gravity with itself, can lead to the decoherence. And what is meant by gravity with itself? Well, you see, the inflaton field gravitates. And in principle, we are decomposing here everything into modes and to first order in perturbation theory, all of that makes sense. Because remember, that's why we did the decomposition, the Fourier decomposition into modes. Because by decomposing everything into co-moving modes, we found, oh, the field oscillators are independent now, they're not coupled. In reality, non-perturbatively speaking, that's not true. Because gravity is a non-linear theory, and it actually is full of self-interactions. Non-linearity of gravity means that if you spell it out, that modes of any wavelength actually interact with modes of any wavelength. Very weakly, because, I mean, gravitational waves interacting with other gravitational waves, super weak. But in principle, it's there. In any case, if you want to read up on that, the book to read is a book by Klaus Kiefer on the decoherence. Okay, but be that as it may, whether the modes decohere right after they individually cross the horizon or when the universe fills with matter, which obviously observes what has been going on, by the end of inflation, the modes have decohered. Okay, so we identified the degrees of freedom, namely the Mukhanov variable and the two polarizations of gravitational waves. And our job is to quantize both of them during inflation. For the tensor modes, that's how the two polarizations of the gravitational waves are called. For the tensor modes, this was the action. And remember, here's the scale factor. That's the scale factor that is here. So this is an FRW scale factor. This is from the zeroth order perturbation here. It's from this term. And then here we just have the two polarizations. I mean, here we have the tensor part of the gravitational field. And we later then decompose that into its two polarizations. The scalar part of the action is containing the Mukhanov variable. And the non-trivial piece here is that instead of the scale factor A of eta, we have this other function Z of eta here. And that had to do with the fact that the Mukhanov variable is this hybrid thing. It's gauge invariant, coordinate system invariant, but at the cost of having this weird linear combination there. And remember that we also figured out that this is actually a highly non-trivial thing because, for example, for De Sitter space, we couldn't even do this. Because for De Sitter space, we don't have an overall trend for the phi field. So therefore, we cannot generally assume that the fluctuations in the inflaton field could be also viewed alternatively as fluctuations in the metric, always. Sometimes they can, but there wouldn't be any guarantee. In fact, in general, you see, if there's a trend, you just have to go a little bit earlier or later in the overall evolution to make up for a small change in the inflaton field. But if the inflaton field doesn't have an overall trend, then you may have to go very, very far. And that meant that this expression actually can explode if you were to go towards De Sitter. And that's because, and mathematically, we see that in the fact that we have here the inverse of the time derivative of the field. If it was no roll instead of slow roll, then that term would explode. Okay, so we should expect that there is some non-triviality arising from the fact that we have here the Mukhanov variable and that it evolves with the Z of eta instead of the A of eta. So we will have to keep all of that in mind if, for example, from the Mukhanov variable, we calculate its fluctuations. And we then translate that at the end of inflation into metric fluctuations. We have to keep in mind where the Mukhanov variable came from. And you know, the expression that it has in terms of the inflaton field and gravity. But apart from that subtle difference here between the A and the Z, and the fact that this has 2 degrees of freedom and that is just one here, we can use exactly the program that we developed over the course for the quantization of these degrees of freedom. Namely, looking at this action, we can read off, this is an action with a time-dependent measure. We know what that does. It gives us a friction term. And so what we do is that we define new variables. From the Mukhanov variable, we go to a variable u, which has the scale factor, which is, you know, the analog of the cosmic scale factor here, which has the scale factor here. And we know that this will lead to the u variable obeying a Klein-Gordon equation without a friction term. And similarly, for the gravitational degree of freedom, we can multiply with a scale factor, get a new tensor field, the Pij, and they too will obey a Klein-Gordon equation without a friction term. We decomposed that into its two polarizations, where the epsilon matrices are polarization matrices. They just have to obey certain conditions that we listed last time. It's analogous to curl being divergence-free. And so we have these two functions here. Instead of having a matrix, we just have two functions. Lambda is here either one or two, the one or the other polarization, and k is the co-moving momentum. And these degrees of freedom, the v, the two polarizations of the gravitational waves, and the Mukhanov variable, suitably scaled, obey these Klein-Gordon equations without a friction term. So we can quantize them as we did before. So this would be the classical field so far, but of course we have to put hats on them and solve them as quantum fields, as equations for quantum fields. And to do that, we need to find mode functions. And the mode functions obey the Klein-Gordon equation. But of course, the mode functions are then used with, together with A and A daggers to actually find a solution to the quantum field theory. And remember that not only do we have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation, not only do the mode functions have to obey the Klein-Gordon equations, but they also have to obey the Wronskian condition in order to ensure that the fields, that the quantum fields that we get from them obey the canonical commutation relations. Everything just as usual. Further, we have to solve that differential equation, these Klein-Gordon equations, with initial conditions. We have to pick those initial conditions. At that point, we remember we know how to pick initial conditions. Namely, we assume that we started out with the adiabatic vacuum state, and the adiabatic vacuum state is defined through exactly initial conditions on the mode function, the amplitude and the derivative of that. It's pretty much like Minkowski space. And that gives us the initial conditions for the Klein-Gordon equations here. And once we have the initial conditions and we have the scaling functions, the rest is numerics. If need be, numerics. Hopefully, we can solve this analytically. But if need be, these are just ordinary differential equations. We can solve them pretty accurately numerically as well. So everything is set up here. Now, let's try to see what behavior to expect as long as possible, as general as possible. And then at some point, we want to do something concretely. And then we make an assumption about what the inflaton potential exactly was, therefore, how exactly the universe was expanding in an accelerated way, and therefore, how exactly the spectrum looks. But let's not make assumptions too early. Let's see how far we can get in full generality. So what do we expect? We do know what the initial conditions are here, right? Remember, the initial conditions are easy because essentially The initial conditions are where the modes have wavelengths that are so small that the k is much larger than these terms. And therefore, it's just like the Minkowski Klein-Gordon equation. And we know how to solve that. But then we have to calculate how that initial solution, it's basically sines and cosines, or e to the power I omega t and e to the power minus I omega t. These are the solutions initially, right, before inflation starts, or at the beginning of inflation. But then these differential equations tell us what happens to these solutions. How do these initial conditions evolve into the full solution over all times? The thing that, in principle, we can do numerically, or hopefully analytically. So what do we expect these solutions that start out as sine and cosine, the solutions to these equations that start out as sine and cosine? In fact, the solution that starts out as e to the power i omega, like in Minkowski space, what do these solutions turn into? How do they behave at late times? Well, at late times, late time means that the mode k in question crossed the Hubble horizon. Remember, for fixed k, the physical wavelength changes over time because it's Hubble expansion. So the physical momentum is actually diminishing. And in these equations, this shows up as this or that term dominating over the k squared term, right? That's when the sign changes. That's when the horizon crossing happens. So at late times, it's this or that term here or there that dominates in the differential equation. The harmonic oscillator is inverted, yada, yada. We have done this in some detail. And so what we expect is that instead of this differential equation describing a harmonic oscillator, it describes an inverted harmonic oscillator, and it doesn't have oscillatory solutions. Instead, we have a growing and a decaying solution, essentially solutions that describe stuff rolling down the inverted potential and stuff trying to roll up onto the potential. So soon after the horizon crossing, the two components in every solution, namely the growing and the decaying solution, will have separated so much. The growing one will have grown so much, and the decaying one will have decayed so much, that the solution is dominated by the growing one, by the growing solution. But what is the growing solution? Let's see. After horizon crossing, these differential equations are essentially the same ones but dropping the k, because these terms are dominant then. So that means that at late times, the dynamics is governed by that and that equation where we just cross out the k squared, because in the overall scheme of things, the k squared term doesn't matter anymore because these are dominant now. And if you remember, I think two lectures ago, we solved differential equations for that case, and we found that there are two basic solutions. Let me remind you of one of them, the growing one. The decaying one we don't need. Let's look at the growing one. How does the growing one behave? And remember, we are not making any assumption. This doesn't have to be the sitter or anything in particular. It's just any accelerated expansion such that these terms dominate. That's all we assume, that they dominate. Then what? Well, then we have that u double prime minus z double prime over z u equal to 0. In other words, we have that this ratio is equal to that ratio. Right? So the Klein-Gordon equation simply becomes that the second derivative of the solution divided by the solution is equal to that scale factor function's second derivative divided by the scale factor. And one of those solutions, in fact, the growing one, is the one where the solution is simply proportional to that scale factor. Clearly, that's going to be a solution, because if u tilde is z, then the left-hand side is equal to the right-hand side. So one of the solutions is that. We could also do the decaying solution, but this is the growing one, obviously the growing one, because this is the solution scaling like the scaling factor. For the Mukhanov variable, it scales like Z, and for the gravitational waves, it scales like A. But this means that not only are the solutions growing and growing proportional to the scale factor, no, what it also means is that the actual mode functions, not the rescaled ones, but the actual mode functions, the ones that obey the equation with the friction term, those mode functions freeze. Right? Because the growing solution goes like the scale factor. And then if we work out what is the actual mode function doing, well, we have to divide by the scale factor to get it. And therefore, we obtain that that freezes. That's ultimately the reason why in the fluctuation spectrum, we have, you know, that behavior. Normally, that would go like 1 over L. But then it settles like this. It's because the mode functions that obey the original Klein-Gordon equation with the friction term, they freeze. So here it is. The Mukhanov variable is 1 over Z times U tilde. But if U tilde is proportional to Z, then we get here a Z over Z. So for large times, this is freezing. And the same for the gravitational wave parts. They are 1 over the scale factor times the P tilde. And if the P tilde goes like A, then the ratio is a constant. So this means that not only for the Sitter space, but whenever the dynamics is such that this sign flips and these terms dominate, the A double prime over A terms or the Z double prime over Z term dominates, then after the horizon crossing, the modulus of the mode function goes to a constant. In fact, the mode function itself goes to constant. I'm just saying the modulus because if you remember, the fluctuation spectrum is expressed directly as being proportional to the modulus of the mode function, right? We calculated that. And by that, I mean the expression that we calculated in two different ways. Remember, the fluctuation spectrum can be defined as the standard deviation of the field's fluctuations in a box, averaged over a box of size L. Or we can also view it as the two-point correlation function of the field with points that are at a distance L. And so remember that it's the modulus of the mode functions, of the actual mode functions, that determines the fluctuation spectrum. Here we have it, right? This is what it was. So the fluctuation spectrum of the Mukhanov variable is k to the power 3 half, that's always there, times the modulus. And for the gravitational waves, it's the modulus of that mode function that matters. Yeah?
Does this hold for any kind of fluctuations, or is it tied to like the fact that we have adiabatic fluctuations?
Did we have what fluctuations?
We've assumed that the fluctuations are adiabatic. Mm-hmm. So does that tie into the fact that they freeze out, or should it happen for any type?
What do you mean by the fluctuations are adiabatic? Do you mean that we chose the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion at the beginning?
Okay, maybe.
Yeah. In fact, it holds very generally. You see, the perturbation theory that we did here for the Klein-Gordon equation has this freezing behavior independently of whether these are classical or quantum fields. That's important because it means that no matter when quantum fluctuations became classical fluctuations, it doesn't matter for these considerations. Right? Also, after inflation, when you do the perturbation theory of fluctuations in the universe, and these are classical fluctuations, it works very similarly. You just don't quantize them. So it's a very general thing. So we saw that on very general grounds, even classical or quantum, on very general grounds, we have that for the quantum fields, as long as we have some sort of inflation defined as dominance of these negative terms in here, so that we get horizon crossing, no matter exactly how that works, I mean, no matter exactly what the behavior is of the scale factors, after horizon crossing, the amplitude will freeze and will stay the same. While the universe keeps expanding, the size of the fluctuations of a co-moving mode stays the same, even as that co-moving mode acquires a larger and larger wavelength because the universe expands under it. So that's a very general phenomenon. Now, let's work this through in an explicit example. You might think, didn't we do an explicit example already, like de Sitter? Yeah, but de Sitter is ruled out, right? Remember, we can't actually do it for de Sitter. So let's do this for another example, so-called power law inflation. In order to define an explicit example, we need to choose an explicit potential for the inflaton field. That's really what matters here. Once we know what the potential is, or once we have made an ansatz for what the potential is, we can identify where it has its slow roll, and then we can work out all of what we just reviewed. We can decompose the scale factor and the field into the zero mode and the quantized small perturbations around that, and so on. So what we will need is a potential that is not a constant. Otherwise, we would get no roll, we would get de Sitter, and the Mukhanov variable cannot be defined in this case, and inflation would go on forever. So we need some other potential than a cosmological constant. In fact, what we need is a temporary cosmological constant, a V that is really slowly rolling. Now, let me remind you that the potential of a scalar field can play the role of a temporary cosmological constant, and therefore it determines what the Hubble parameter is at any time. If the potential is very large, it means that the Hubble parameter is very large. It means that the universe is expanding in a very accelerated way. And if you remember from, I think, two lectures back, what we found is that the Hubble parameter, so the coefficient in the exponential expansion law, is the square root of the potential of the inflaton field. It's not exactly itself, it's the Hubble parameter is the square root of the potential. So the expansion is not exponential, really. You can write it as e to the power ht, but the h is itself time dependent, and therefore it's no longer exponential in general. If the expansion is caused not by a cosmological constant, in which case the h would be constant, but if it's caused by potential, then that coefficient in the exponent would not be constant, if you insist on writing it as an exponential. All right, so we need to find a function v of phi, which we can also view as a function h of phi, because the potential translates into a momentary Hubble parameter. Now, as we discussed, we really don't know what the potential of the inflaton field could be. In order for inflation to work, it needs the slow roll phase. And the potential might look like this. But if, for example, the Higgs field was to be the actual inflaton field, which would be conceptually very economical, then let's see, how could that look? Well, here's phi, here's v of phi. It could look like this. The Higgs field looks like that, remember? It goes like this, and it would be something that is like a minus mu phi squared plus lambda phi to the 4. That would be the standard Higgs potential. But we don't really know, and what we really need for the Higgs phenomenon is this, that there's a minimum, or actually you should view this as in a complex plane, it's a complex field. And so, yeah, you have this minimum with elevated value of phi. And roughly speaking, why does it give a mass? Imagine you have the action of a fermion. So you have like psi bar d slash psi, that would be a massless fermion's action. And then you might have the interaction of this fermion with a field, something like psi bar phi, well, you may need gamma factors and so on, psi, right? And then d4x, square root of g, and so on. Now, you see, if phi actually has a vacuum expectation value that is not zero, it would play the role of a mass. Anyway, so what we need is for the Higgs phenomenon, for the spontaneous symmetry breaking, is that there's a minimum here for elevated value of phi. What we need for inflation is something else. We would need that this potential eventually flattens, but not completely, right? That could be like this. So it could be that, you know, we have this low roll here. Right? That could be. But nobody knows. Yeah?
Let's say that, like, we talked a little bit about the inflaton being the Higgs and things like that. Let's say that we take this picture seriously.
Yeah.
Let's say that inflation finishes.
Yeah.
And then we're in the heating phase. Then what's happening? Like, is that?
Well, the temperature would
be the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs, or do we need to make it go up again and then symmetry?
It would be up again. It would be. And the reason is that while it goes down already, it would create all of those particles. You would have a universe filled with plasma. It would be very high temperature. And the thing is that you should keep in mind that these potentials, and that's a major difficulty in this whole Higgs inflation thing, that these potentials, these coefficients are running with renormalization, right? And so just intuitively speaking, when the temperature is high enough, the particles don't care about that bump, right? And they behave as if they were massless anyway, right? And then as the universe cools, then it would settle into that. But initially it would be so hot that everything is radiation dominated anyway. And the mass, whether they have it or not, just plays no role. Like an electron has half an MeV. That's nothing compared to the energy that comes from the decay of the inflaton field. But overall, I mean, you're pointing to an important thing, which is that we can't just write down a potential and say nature works this way. Because when you take, I hope you do, take a course in quantum field theory for particle physics, you will see that the interactions between particles actually mean that all of the components of an action get what is called renormalized. The field scales with the energy at which you look at it. The coupling constants scale with the energy at which you look at it. The masses change with the energy at which you look at things. And so the whole picture is dynamical there.
And then one follow-up. And then the Higgs has 4 real degrees of freedom. Which one is the inflaton?
Well,
which could be the...
There is no need for inflation to be generated by a single scalar field. There is a huge amount of literature on multi-field inflation, which is not necessarily a good thing, right? On one hand, yes, if you want to match to the Higgs, but on the other hand, the more fields you introduce, the more knobs you have to turn to explain everything, right? I think it was Pauli who said that with 4 free parameters, he can write down a function that resembles an elephant, and with the 5th, he can make the trunk wiggle, right? So we don't want too many things. We need to be economical with the assumptions. So,
were you referring to the fact that you get screening and anti-screening for those, for example, the mu and the lambda over there? So you don't settle into Higgs minimum at high temperatures, so you can't even use that
kind of a mechanism. Wait. Careful there. You get anti-screening for non-abelian gauge theories like QCD. I think if you just had a scalar field and nothing else, if it's just about the Higgs, it would renormalize its potential, but I don't think it would have anti-screening.
Well, we have some parameters between your anti-screening, let's say the coupling constants or some.
Yeah.
There'll be a screen or anti-screen as you go into like, we don't have that here.
No, I don't think, maybe just to tell everybody, in case you're not aware of this, the reason why, for example, the coupling constant is running with the energy scale is this. Imagine two electrons, and you wonder, what's the attractive force between them? What's the energy between them? Well, it depends on the charges and the distance, you might think. But imagine those two electrons are in a crystal. Well, then they're going to deform the crystal around them because the electrons attract the positive charges and repel the negative charges, so they're going to deform that. And that means that there's a bubble of polarization around each of the two electrons. And that is in part screening their, it's in part screening their charges. Now, if you bring those two electrons really close together in the crystal, then there is not much in between them to do this screening effect, and then they see their full charge. And similarly, in the vacuum, because in the vacuum too, you have polarization. If a photon is traveling, then it can split into an electron-positron pair, which then recombines into a photon, and then the photon keeps going on its way. But temporarily, while there was this electron-positron pair, it will react to charges because the electron and the positron are charged. And so you get a polarization of the vacuum. And the closer the two electrons are, the less this is an effect. But the further they are away from another, the more this is an effect. So there's more screening between them. So the force between them becomes weaker as they are further away, and I don't mean the Coulomb decay, I mean the actual alpha, the actual coupling constant gets weaker as you go away. Of course, it settles very quickly to almost a constant value, but it keeps decaying, whereas if you get the electrons very, very close together, then the force between them really starts to get really strong and, in fact, diverges. So that would be a screening effect, where you have polarization induced, even in the vacuum, between charges. And that's screening those charges in part. But what Zapero was referring to is that there's also the phenomenon of anti-screening, where the interactions, due to their non-trivial, non-abelian nature, can also have the opposite effect, where the further away the two charges are, the stronger the force comes between them rather than the weaker. Right? And that happens for QCD. That happens between quarks. And it's ultimately because, unlike photons that do not interact directly, gluons do interact directly. So if you have two laser beams, they would pass right through each other. But two gluon beams would not, because there is actually there are interaction Hamiltonians between gluons. And so the polarization is just much more complicated. There is no simple intuition that I know of that would explain why we get anti-screening, but we do. And the idea is that this explains why we have confinement for strongly interacting things. So we can't separate quarks. You know, you can rip apart a proton, but you will never achieve individual quarks because the force just the potential between two quarks increases linearly. And so eventually, as you rip apart two quarks or three quarks, you have to put in so much energy that it's enough energy to produce more quarks, quark-antiquark pairs. And so what you typically get is that if you try to rip a particle apart, such as a proton or a meson, then, for example, by a collision, yes, you may rip those two quarks apart, but then you get a chain of quarks and antiquarks produced between them. That means, again, you know, two quark, a quark antiquark particles, but you never can isolate them. And that anti-screening, I don't expect to happen for a pure Higgs field. One would have to do the calculation, but I'm pretty sure that scalar fields don't do that. They have other weird stuff, but not that.
What I was referring to is if you're probing smaller distances, don't these, which lambda and the mu for the Higgs field change?
Oh, yeah, yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, 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 exactly. You can, through renormalization, it can happen that mu becomes positive, right? And then you have that it's just a potential like that with a minimum here. And then you would say, oh, at those energies, at these temperatures, there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. But then as the temperature cools down, then you have that, and the universe would have to settle there. Oof, the time. All right. OK, good. So we don't know what the potential really is. It might be a Higgs-like thing like that. And by the way, this would have to be way higher there.
Right.
OK, so. Because that's the electroweak scale here, and that is, you know, almost Planck scale. So we don't know what it is. So what we can do is we can parameterize it. We do essentially a Taylor expansion here. We pick a point in the middle of the slow roll. Some call it the pivot point. And then we do a Taylor expansion of the potential around that point. And these are the so-called slow roll parameters. So, and they're called epsilon, eta, and xi, and then others, but we can't measure the others. So epsilon of phi is the first slow roll parameter. And you see it has one derivative, the second has two derivatives, and the third has the third derivative in it. And these combinations turn out to be convenient for the expansion, but you could also just use directly the h prime, the h double prime, the h triple prime. Remember that the square root of V is the Hubble parameter. So we express it in terms of the Hubble parameter, but here I gave you the expressions in terms of V2. It doesn't matter. You can translate the one into the other. So this is like a Taylor expansion here, if you look at it at one point, right? At one value of phi. Now, what would be the simplest case that we can choose? Well, the simplest case would be the case where we choose, let's say, the epsilon of phi. You know, in principle, this is a coefficient, the first derivative here, that we can calculate anywhere here, right? And it will give us some number. But for simplicity, let's just say that the epsilon of phi is actually constant. Let's say that this first derivative over h is constant over the slow roll. What does that mean? What is implied if we say that epsilon of phi is actually c, independently of the pivot point, independently of where we calculate, it's always the same. This is just some constant c. Well, it's not going to be the zeta, that's for sure, because for the zeta, h prime would be 0. The v and the h would just not depend on phi. It would be a no roll instead of a slow roll. So what kind of non-de Sitter is it? And remember that the smaller the epsilon is, the closer it is to the Sitter, because the closer it is to h prime equal to 0. So the epsilon is parameterizing how far away we are from the Sitter. But it's a very special case, because we're assuming here that the epsilon is actually a constant, when in reality it could depend on phi. OK, so if we choose the epsilon of phi to be a constant, then we have that a constant is this. And from that, we can immediately tell that we have that the Hubble parameter, which is the square root of the potential, has to take this particular form. It's an exponential. So the v of phi is some sort of exponential. So the slow roll is actually the roll of, it's a piece of an exponential. I'd remember that we are not trying to describe the entire curve here. We're just trying to describe this piece. And so what we are saying here is that this piece can be viewed as being part of an exponential here of that form. And I'll leave it to you as an exercise to calculate exactly what exponential that is. And a beautiful thing here that simplifies the calculations is that if you choose epsilon to be a constant, then the eta and the xi are the same constant. It just follows automatically. You might think, well, how come? you fix one Taylor coefficient and you get the second and the third for free. Yes, because if I evaluated this only at one point, well, the derivative at one point doesn't tell me what the derivative, what the second derivative is or what the third derivative is. But what we did is we said that this, we said that this derivative, this h prime over h ratio, is constant for all phi. And that, of course, already fixed, as we saw here, what that is. And therefore, we have the second and third derivatives. Right? If you give the first derivative of a function everywhere, well, then you can also calculate the second derivative everywhere and the third derivative everywhere. That's what we did. But in general, you would go with a pivot point and say, OK, I want to determine what is epsilon of phi at this point, what is eta of phi at this point, what is psi of phi at this point. And there is a lot of work trying to work out exactly that. So then, if that's the potential, what is the expansion rate? What is A of t in this case? Well, it turns out that if we choose epsilon of phi to be a constant c, nothing to do with the speed of light, it's just a constant, right? If we choose epsilon of phi to be a constant c, then the scale factor of the universe goes like this. It goes like a number times t to the power of 1 over c. Very cool. Remember that the smaller c is, the closer we are to the zeta. And here we see that the smaller c is, the larger is that power. So we get t to higher and higher power. It never becomes an exponential, right? It is not an exponential, but it becomes a more and more dramatic acceleration nevertheless. This is the scale factor in proper time. Let's calculate it in conformal time. And remember, we had the formula for calculating the conformal time and then expressing the scale factor in that. It's a little calculation that I'm sure you can do by now. You find that the scale factor function as a function of the conformal time is given by minus 1 over eta h. This would be the zeta. It's exactly the expression of the zeta. And then times 1 over 1 minus epsilon. Epsilon is a small positive number. So this is almost 1. So this is very, very close to the conformal time expression for the scale factor in the zeta, but it's not the same. But we still have, for example, that the conformal time ranges from minus infinity to 0 only. Future infinity is at conformal time 0. So that intuition still stands here. Also, remember that the zeta inflation doesn't have a big bang. Power law inflation, and this is what it is called because this is a power law, power law inflation does. Because what we have here is, you know, this could be t to the power of 100 or whatever, right? If this is t to the power of 100, you see if c is very small, this could be 100, so it's t to the power of 100. Well, then at t equal to 0, the scale factor is 0. Everything was at one point. That would actually be a big bang. For the zeta, we never had that because it's an exponential expansion. The universe gets smaller and smaller as you go further and further back in time, but it's never shrinking to 0. But this one would. So it's really qualitatively different from the zeta. Even though you can kind of approach it, it's not a nice limit to the zeta. And that's good because things are really different for the zeta. All right, so we have the scale factor in terms of conformal time. And now we also need the scale factor, the modified scale factor for the Mukhanov variable. That's the z of eta. We can calculate that now because we have the a of eta. Calculate that factor here. And what we obtain is that the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, has this behavior here. So the Mukhanov variable rescaled in order to get rid of the friction term obeys this differential equation here. That's the Klein-Gordon equation in the case of power law inflation. That's just what you get when you calculate z double prime over z. So you just work out this part here, plug it in here, you get that. Here the coefficient nu is 3/2 plus c over 1 minus c. Let's see, what do we get if we let z go to 0? So we approach the sitter, what do we get? Well, for the sitter, we would get, if this goes to 0, this part would go to 0, and the nu is 3/2. We square that, we get 9/4. Minus 1/4 is 8/4, which is 2. So we have minus 2 over eta squared, which is the differential equation for the sitter. But it's not exactly the sitter. There's a bit of a difference there. And again, we can find the two fundamental solutions to this differential equation. And then we can use the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion to find the right linear combination at the beginning of inflation. And then we follow those fundamental solutions to late times. And we obtain what that solution does at late times. I did all of that for you already here. In principle, it's the same thing that we did before. So for the Bunch-Davis initial conditions, Bunch-Davis vacuum is another word for the adiabatic vacuum in the context of inflation and cosmology. So this is the solution to that differential equation, which obeys the vacuum, the adiabatic vacuum initial condition. That's that mode function. And here we have a Henkel function of the first kind of order nu. This is what happened to the Bessel J and the Bessel Y functions when we change this coefficient here. But remember, it's as usual. For early times, this is just sine and cosine. It's just, in fact, it's cosine plus I times sine. It's the e to the power I omega t. So that's the solution for all times, which at early times has the right initial conditions. And then we look at it at late times. And we know already from at the beginning of what we did at the beginning of this lecture today, namely that inevitably, the mode function must settle. I mean, this one has to explode because it's a frictionless one. But if you translate it back into the original mode function, then it will freeze after horizon crossing. So this function here explodes like that. So that's the solution at late times. This is just the expansion of the Henkel function at late times. And we get certain behaviors here with the nu. And if you just chose that nu to go towards 3/2, then that would be the solution that we had previously found for the sitter. So now the magnitude of the intrinsic curvature fluctuations after horizon crossing can be expressed. Because remember that once we have the mode function, we can rescale that into the mode in the true mode function for the Klein-Gödel equation with the friction term. And then we have to keep in mind how that's related to, I mean, non-trivially related then to the curvature fluctuations. And what we obtain is that the intrinsic curvature fluctuations. This is the Mukhanov variable, and after inflation ends, that's intrinsic curvature fluctuations. You can also view it as inflaton fluctuations just before that, but as inflation ends, these are just intrinsic curvature fluctuations. Their spectrum is given by this expression then, after horizon crossing. Again, looks kind of similar perhaps from far to what we had for the sitter, but it really isn't. And that's because as you substitute everything backwards into this calculation here, you run into the fact that the z of eta is not the a of eta. And therefore, you get non-trivialities here. The same non-trivialities that told us that the sitter is out. We can't have the sitter because the Mukhanov variable itself would explode. So we should expect that this end result also explodes in the actual De Sitter case. This cannot work smoothly for C going to zero. And it doesn't. And why is that? Well, you see, what we had found previously is that the fluctuation spectrum in the De Sitter case was simply proportional to H here. That's what we had found. But now we find that it goes like H squared over H prime. If you substitute everything in backwards, that's what you get. And that expression, first of all, is not a constant. In the case of De Sitter, the Hubble parameter is a constant because we have a constant acceleration. This is not a constant because it needs to be evaluated for every mode separately. Whenever it crosses the horizon, we have to ask, what's H now? And what's H prime now? And then we get that. So the spectrum now is non-trivially affected by the fact that we have a slow rolling going on. But also, if the rolling is not all that slow, if it's actually, if the rolling is too slow, if it's more of a no roll, then this would be zero. And the whole thing would blow up. Right? So we recover the fact that the sitter is not actually possible. In other words, you can also view this as a kind of amplification of it, because we have this sensitivity here. On the other hand, what we should also say is that what this means is that what we are actually observing, at least from the perspective of, if we only use this, no other phenomenology, then what we can observe is only H squared over H prime, not H itself, but H squared over H prime. So there's a trade-off. You can assume that, you know, H is smaller or larger as long as you make up for it with a faster or slower roll. That would have the same effect. And not quite, because, you know, it has to be consistent. The H prime is not decoupled from what the H does, because these are functions. You know, you can't just choose the function and the derivative independently. But at the point, you could. But you have curves. Ideally, you observe a whole spectrum, and then these things are constrained. But be that as it may, you have one global degree of freedom here, and you can mess around with the H and the H prime. But we definitely get a relationship between how the amplitudes depend, the fluctuation amplitudes depend on the scale at which you look at them, the k, because that's given by that function here, and the slow roll itself. So in principle, if you observe the spectrum and the CMB accurately enough, we measure essentially this, from which we can then deduce this function here. In practice, we can't get an actual function. We are happy if we get like an indication as to what the first two or three slow roll parameters are at a pivot point. Now, this is just to remind you of the intuition for why these fluctuations blow up towards inflation. Remember, it's because if you have no roll or very, very, very slow roll, then there is less of an overall trend in how phi goes, and therefore fluctuations in phi cannot so easily be absorbed by a change of coordinates. You might have to go a very long way until you can make up for the fluctuation in phi. Just like a river is meandering in a region that is very flat. Okay, so we will come back to the tensor modes. Let me just remind you of the timeline. Here's the timeline that we discussed. And what we just calculated is the initial conditions for the scalar fluctuations, and that translates into inhomogeneity is here at the end of inflation, when the universe was filled with a plasma that would then go on to reverberate and expand and cool down. That's what we calculated here, what that spectrum is. And that spectrum then went through this period of plasma physics until we have that the plasma becomes a gas of mostly hydrogen, which is then transparent, and then the temperature fluctuations in the CMB are being observed. Technically speaking, you can view it better as not as temperature fluctuations originally, because these things didn't start as fluctuations of the temperature of the plasma. The plasma was technically of the same temperature everywhere when it was created, because it was created when the inflaton field rolled down quickly to its minimum and gave away all of its energy into the plasma. Instead, the fluctuations were fluctuations of curvature, of intrinsic curvature, which means that the fluctuations initially were just gravitational troughs and wells, hills and valleys. And therefore, perhaps the better way to look at it is to say that it was equal temperature, but the photons had to climb out of a valley to us, or they came down from a hill to us, which makes them appear colder or warmer. Right. It's worth saying that this picture that we arrived at today was actually predicted before it was measured. And that's, I think, pretty cool. There were competing theories, and this one succeeded. Here are some measured data. Here you have essentially the Fourier transform of the cosmic microwave background fluctuation spectrum, but it's not Fourier transform because it's on a two-dimensional sphere in the sky. You do the expansion instead of Fourier, you do it in the spherical harmonics. But essentially that's the same. For large L, that's the same. And the fact that there are these peaks is due to the reverberations that happened in the plasma that were started by the initial inhomogeneities. So far, so good. That's been measured and has been used to fix cosmological parameters. So now it looks like the universe is having k equal to zero, meaning, remember, k negative means that it is hyperbolic spacetime. K positive would mean that it closes into a sphere. K equals zero means that it's essentially at every time slice something like R3, infinite in size. And there's no indication that it is finite size or that it is hyperbolic. It seems to be pretty close to complete flatness, which, according to inflation, is not an accident, because if you have an expansion that's enormously large, you would expect that it basically leads to a flat spacetime. Doesn't mean that it's actually infinite, right? It's just inflation says you should get something that looks like that. And then you can read off various parameters if you incorporate the theory of inflation into cosmology. And the consensus nowadays is that the cosmological constant makes up about 70% of the energy density in the universe. I should say that the energy density that's needed to make k equal to zero is called the critical energy density, and we seem to have that. And the cosmological constant contributes 70% of that, which is why we said earlier that we are already in that phase today where the universe's energy momentum tensor is dark energy dominated. Dark energy is just another word for the cosmological constant. Well, dark energy could also be the vacuum energy of space-time, but that could be the cosmological constant. Then the rest of the energy density in the universe is made up by matter. So 30% of the energy density in the universe is made up by matter, and dark matter is 90% of that. So that the visible matter, the matter that we actually know anything about, is only 10% of the 30%. It's like 3%. The cosmic microwave background also carries energy, and it contributes about 1/100,000th of the total energy density of the universe, which is not that little, right? If you were traveling in outer space, you just see it everywhere. Oh, and I also put here that the we can use the CMB to measure our peculiar velocity. And our peculiar velocity against the cosmic microwave background, which defines, so to speak, the cosmic rest frame, I mean, the one of observers that do not have a peculiar velocity, against that we have about a velocity of 370 kilometers per second, but it changes every day, right? It changes every day because we're going around the sun at the speed of about 25 kilometers a second, and so it's plus minus about 25 kilometers, depending on the season. And correspondingly, you have an overall redshift and blue shift of that picture. But this was all about the scalar modes, about the Mukhanov variable. Maybe just briefly about the tensor modes. Tensor modes obey a Klein-Gordon equation of the exact kind that we considered throughout the course. And we obtain for the scale factor now a double prime over A for the power law inflation case. By the way, I should say, I shouldn't hype power law too much, because the evidence is now strong enough that we know that the slow roll parameters, the three slow roll parameters, are not all the same and constant. So we know it's not power law exactly. But power law is great because we can actually solve the differential equations and calculate things explicitly, and that's more transparent than doing it just by numerics. Okay, so for tensor modes, we have that A double prime over A, that famous term that changes the sign in the Klein-Gordon equation, is this expression. And it turns out to be then, if you work it out in as a function of conformal time, it's this expression here. And again, that reduces to the sitter for the case where nu goes to 3/2. We can solve the Klein-Gordon equation for that scale factor as well, explicitly. And what we obtain is this expression. Now, that expression is proportional to h, as we should have predicted, because it's exactly the same procedure as we did for the sitter space. And now there is no reason to expect that there's something non-trivial happening as we go towards the sitter case, because this is not a matter of the Mukhanov variable and so on. That doesn't play into it. So indeed, as you let C go to 0 and nu go to 3/2 and you approach the sitter, this just becomes the fluctuation spectrum for the sitter space with just a constant Hubble parameter here. But it's not constant here, because the potential is slowly, I mean, the field is slowly rolling, the potential is slowly changing, the h is slowly changing. So for every mode, its k determines when we have to read off the h value. And so we get the tensor fluctuations are proportional to h. But since h is evolving over time during inflation, we have that the spectrum is not constant. Now, we would love to measure this, but cannot measure it yet. As we discussed, this should have left an imprint in the so-called B polarization. That is to say, the curl of the polarization is called B polarization, because just like the magnetic field is always a curl, this is also always a curl. And you see, the magnetic field is not a gradient, because there are no magnetic monopoles. And so it's called the B polarization, not because it's an actual magnetic field, but because it has this curl property. So experiments found that, but most of the polarization is actually E polarization. So it's a gradient, and therefore doesn't have that origin. It has other astrophysical origin that is not cosmological. And the part that is bipolarization, the part that is a curl, is probably not from here, but from some foreground. But it's a big price in cosmology. If it could be measured, it would mean that we've measured quantum gravity. Because remember that that would be there even if there was no intraton field. This is just a quantization of gravity itself. This was the part of the metric that is fluctuating independently of whether there is an energy momentum tensor or not. It's just wild curvature. So we would actually measure evidence of the quantum fluctuations of the metric itself if we could measure that. Unfortunately, still too slow. We are still not fast enough to figure out how that could be measured. If we could measure that, not only would we have evidence for quantum gravity, but also we would have evidence for what H itself is. And then we can combine that with the measurement that we've already made of H squared over H prime. So that also gives us H prime. And so we would have a much better handle on this. And since these are two different ways of looking at the same H, and therefore at the same potential, remember the potential, H is just the square root of the potential, we have non-trivial consistency conditions that relate the, in fact, papers written on this, exactly what the consistency conditions are. See, the predictions for the B modes is not independent of that of the scalar part. And so this is a very stringent test for inflation. If the consistency conditions were not to be obeyed, then inflation would seriously be in trouble. Probably we would have to invent or use multi-field inflations with all sorts of tricks to account for it. Usually people come up with ways to make it fit, but it would no longer be natural, right? And so this is the consistency between this prediction and the previous one, if only we can measure both parts, the polarization and the temperature, is considered to be a really stringent test. And I suppose Mukhanov and others might get a Nobel Prize if that was to be measured and confirmed. But so far, they're still waiting with that. Okay, so far with the cosmology. And then next week, Hawking.